Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Harvard and the Unabomber, the education of an American terrorist, is our topic today on Radio Curious. It's also the name of a recent book written by Professor Alston Chase, who lives in rural Montana. In this book, based on the life and experience of Theodore Kaczynski, who came to be known as the Unabomber, Chase characterizes him as a product of post-World War II angst, a genius-level mathematician from an idealistic, bookish family who, while at Harvard University, was involved in questionable and possibly unethical psychological experiments supported by Harvard. Chase does not apologize for Kaczynski. Instead, he puts the crimes and the man behind them in context, examining the links between intelligence and evil, and the forces that led Kaczynski to become a serial killer. I spoke with Alston Chase and asked him to begin by commenting on the Unabomber's manifesto.
First hit me when I read the manifesto before I knew the author. At that time, the FBI assumed that whoever wrote the manifesto was probably someone who was about in his 40s. When I read the manifesto in 95, my reaction was, my gosh, this is right out of Harvard's gen ed curriculum of the 1950s. So I immediately suspected that the author, the Unabomber, was older than the FBI had been suspecting, and it turned out to be correct. What I meant by that is that during the 1940s and 50s, many, many colleges and universities around the country, not among them Harvard, but by far not only Harvard, had embraced a form of undergraduate curriculum called general education, which required students to take certain courses, mainly of a historical orientation in the history of Western civilization, the history of science, the history of literature, and so on. And the curricula that existed, was presented to students during the 1950s, was by and large very pessimistic. It's what I call the culture of despair that the students were immersed in. It's important to remember that the 1950s students were being taught by faculty members who had fought in World War II, or who had were certainly adults in World War II, and had witnessed the horrors of that war, and also the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, what did this experience of that group of faculty members bring to their curriculum? The sense of despair that you describe?
Yes. Well, I think first of all, a real worry that technology could destroy civilization. A real worry that the machine, as it were, was taking over our lives.
Well, that's what President Eisenhower said in his farewell speech.
That's very much the same thing, yes. This was strong not only among the humanists in the faculty, but also many of the scientists as well. People like Norbert Wiener at MIT, who had helped develop aiming devices for missiles, was one of the people whose works I read as an undergraduate at Harvard, warning about the dangers of technology. So this was broad scale across the curriculum, although, of course, the humanists tended to be most worried about it. We had entered, after World War II, into the Cold War. And the Cold War was very real, and it seemed to suggest the imminent possibility of that we could be plunged into World War III, which might end life on Earth as we know it.
I remember it rather well, with a certain amount of fear.
Yes, that's right. And I remember that national magazines were publishing these articles on how to build bomb shelters out of books. well, and all this sort of thing.
How do you feel that this affected Ted Kaczynski? Or maybe that question is premature. Perhaps you should explain the psychological experiments in which he participated during his years at Harvard.
Fine. I might mention one other aspect of the curriculum, though, that is very important for understanding Ted Kaczynski, and that is that there was a particular philosophy that was very popular among the faculty members at that time, in philosophy, but also in other fields, that was often called logical positivism or emotivism. And it was the view that only scientific statements are meaningful. Only scientific statements can be rationally defended. That therefore moral judgments or ethical judgments are not rational and are merely subjective expressions of emotions. This was an idea that Kaczynski absorbed virtually word for word as I've just spoken it, which he never ever forgot, so that much later in his life when he was bombing people and killing people, he would confess. He kept a secret diary, which I quote from in my book. This was written in code, or sometimes in Spanish, sometimes a combination of Spanish and code. But in his diary, he would confess to feeling guilty when he had killed or maimed someone. And then he'd immediately catch himself and say, oh, but I recognize that there is no morality, and that moral feelings are merely subjective, and that are not rational, and that therefore, if I feel this way, it's only because I've been brainwashed into feeling this way by society. And if I exercise my willpower and use my brains, I can recognize that there is no morality, and therefore there's nothing wrong with killing. So he would talk to himself this way, and to assuage his guilt. Well, this is a philosophy that he got right out of Harvard. In fact, I found it expressed by him in a sophomore philosophy essay.
In an essay that he wrote?
That he wrote. And now that ties in with your question, because the other very important aspect of Kaczynski's life and the turning, A, that provided another factor that led to a turning point, was that beginning with his sophomore year, he became a subject of a three-year-long experiment, psychological experiment, conducted by a prestigious Harvard psychologist by the name of Henry A. Murray. Now, Professor Murray had been a colonel in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA, during World War II. And in that position, he had headed up a division that tested applicants to the OSS to see whether they could, for example, withstand the third degree if they were captured and tortured by the enemy. And Professor Murray devised tests to determine whether how well a person could withstand the third degree.
Can you describe some of those tests for us?
Well, at the OSS, they would tell a candidate to come to this room at a certain time, and they would walk into the room, and they would be put in a chair facing a very bright light, with the light in their eyes, so they had to squint, and they couldn't really see their interrogators. And then the interrogators would, they wouldn't physically attack them, but they would verbally attack them and just try to shake them. And they had developed a scenario that, let's say, this person was supposedly found in a room where he wasn't supposed to be, or picking up some object he was not supposed to have picked up. And they would cross-examine him as to why he was there, why he picked this object up, and the person had to think on his feet, and metaphorically speaking, think quickly and make up a story, and then the interrogators would try to break that story down.
So this is what happened to Kaczynski?
No, well, that was the start of Professor Murray's so-called assessment method. But what happened to Kaczynski was actually worse, I think. Because shortly after the end of World War II, in the late 40s, Professor Murray had returned to Harvard, and he had decided to continue experimentations of the same kind. The intent was to put undergraduate subjects under intense stress to see what would happen, to see whether he could, if you like, break them down. And this was initially done for the Department of the Navy. Professor Murray began those experiments in 1949 and ran a series of three-year experiments with different undergraduate groups, including the last of the series. And each series, by the way, each of the series was more elaborate than the last. Kaczynski was in the last cohort, the cohort of experimental subjects that went through this in between 1959 and 1962. And it was by far the most elaborate. In Kaczynski's case, what they did was to tell the students to write an essay in which they would express their philosophy of life, and then they would be told that on a given day, they could come to the annex, which is the building in which Professor Murray conducted his experiments, and there debate their philosophy of life with another undergraduate and his philosophy of life. But in fact, they were being deceived. On the given day, the students at Kaczynski came to the annex, was brought into a room with very, very bright lights. His shirt was taken and jacket was taken off, and shoes and socks. Electrodes were attached to their wrist, chest, ankles that would measure their heart, respiration rate, and blood pressure. They were facing a one-way mirror behind which a team of psychologists were watching him. Their facial expressions were being captured by a hidden camera. And then, rather than debate another undergraduate such as themselves, in walked someone that Murray called our trained accomplice, who was a law school student who had been trained and instructed to attack the student, not physically, but to ridicule him, to try to demean him, to raise him to anger, to cause self-doubt, if you like, to really deconstruct his ego. Then after this session, the student would be asked to come back over a period of months and review over and over again these pictures of himself being raised to anger and humiliation and shame and every conceivable emotion, where the purpose really was to see how much they could take of this.
What kinds of records are available that you were able to review with regard to the test to which Kaczynski was subjected?
Well, first of all, I was able to view the records of all the other 20. There were 22, including Kaczynski, in this particular series of 59 to 62. I was able to view the records of all but Kaczynski. Harvard would not allow me to see the Kaczynski file.
Why? Why wouldn't they?
Well, the reason they gave was that they were under a contractual agreement to not disclose the experimental subject's identity. And since I knew, Kaczynski had told me these individuals were identified in the data sets, as they were called, in the data on this experiment, only by code name. And as Kaczynski had told me, what his code name was, they said, well, they couldn't let me look at his files because I would be able to know who the person was. I would know because Kaczynski had told me. But they suggested that for that reason they would not actually let him look at his file. However, first I might add that Kaczynski told me, this was confirmed by a couple of members of his defense team, that the defense team had asked Harvard to turn over Kaczynski's data set, which would including the assessments made by Professor Murray and his other assistants and colleagues of the psyches of Kaczynski.
And were you able to look at those?
And the amazing thing is, Harvard would not allow Kaczynski himself to look at them.
Even during the course of his trial?
Even though his life was on stake, Harvard would not allow. Harvard turned over the raw data for the results from his the raw data when he answering questions. For example, he took the thematic apperception test, or TAT as it's called, and he was allowed to see his answers, but not the professor's assessment of his answers. And of course, the assessment is what would have been more valuable, certainly for the defense team.
But couldn't those answers be reassessed by a trained psychologist at this point, looking back at it?
Yes, and in fact, that's what happened in one case. Kaczynski did eventually get a hold, as I say, of the TAT, his answers to the TAT. And following the trial, at his request, his attorney sent his answers to an expert on the TAT, Dr. Bertrand Coran at Michigan State University, and asked that Professor Coran, grade or assess Kaczynski's answers, in fact, Coran was presented with the answers to all 22 subjects, so that. Coran did not know Kaczynski's identity, and so Coran's scoring was a blind scoring. So he couldn't, he wasn't, he did not know which of the 22 was Kaczynski. And Dr. Coran evaluated the TAT as follows: on a scale of 0 to 10, with respect to schizophrenia, where 0 is absence, total absence, and 10 is extreme. Kaczynski received a 0. On other mental health index, Kaczynski received a 2 on a 0 to 10 scale. So from that, which is perhaps the best information we have on Kaczynski's mental health as a sophomore at Harvard, it would appear that he was at that time completely sane.
And that is essentially what the psychiatrist who the judge at his trial in Sacramento determined.
Yes. Well, the psychiatrist at this trial, the one, Dr. Sally Johnson, who examined Kaczynski for the court, concluded there was a rather tentative conclusion, but that he perhaps suffered from it was a paranoia paranoid. He was perhaps a latent paranoid schizophrenic. That is to say, he showed no overt symptoms at the time she interviewed him, but nevertheless, she said that she believed that perhaps that he was a latent paranoid schizophrenic because she said he harbored delusional beliefs and an abnormal lifestyle. And what she had in mind was that he lived alone in a cabin in the Montana wilds, which to those of us who've done that wouldn't see as being a sign of insanity, but perhaps the reverse. And the other was his delusional beliefs were his Unabomber philosophy as expressed in the manifesto, those were hardly delusional. They were ideas shared and concerns shared by millions of Americans. And as I say, many, many of the Harvard faculty at the time Kaczynski was a student.
Looking at Kaczynski's experience at Harvard, and the philosophy of the general education that was taught at that time, and the psychological experience, how would you describe or relate these as formative factors in causing him to do what he did?
Well, these are all elements in his life, and they all no single one certainly was if you like, made him do what he did. But if we look at the bigger picture, we just look to begin fitting pieces into a puzzle. We see here's a young man who was just turned 16 before he entered Harvard, who had been pushed very hard academically by his parents and therefore lacked a lot of social skills, and who harbored enormous anger at his parents for having pushed him so hard academically and for having made him such a, he feels they were to blame for making him such a loner. Then you put this into context of entering Harvard and encountering this pessimistic philosophy that's heavily laced with the notions of concerns about what technology was doing to civilization, and then the positivism, there is no morality. And then encountering in Professor Murray somebody who was indeed a Cold War warrior. Professor Murray had, although not one of the major players in the Cold War, was nevertheless, he had done work for the CIA, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy. The Kaczynski experiments were done in part for the Navy Department. So in Professor Murray, he encountered the system, if you like, incarnate. And the system was dedicated, as Professor Murray indeed was, dedicated to using behavioral psychology to transform people into better citizens, as Murray defined better citizen. All of these things certainly came together for Kaczynski by the time he had graduated at Harvard. By that time, he had already begun to formulate his what would become the Unabomber philosophy.
But in that formational time, did he begin to formulate his concepts of killing people and his plan to do so?
No, he began having, by his senior year at Harvard, nightmares in which he would imagine himself leading people in rebellions against the system. He had not really formulated a plan to do that. As he said to Dr. Johnson, at that time he was too inhibited. He was a good boy, and he wanted to be good. And he saw himself as too, as he put it himself later, he thought of himself as having been too well brainwashed by society and had still accepted society's norms of morality. At Harvard, he had not quite, while he was an undergraduate, he had not quite reached that point, but shortly thereafter, he did.
When you were preparing your book, how much time were you able to spend with Kaczynski?
At the beginning of the trial, I wrote him, but the letters, the attorneys were not letting mail get through to him, and he never saw my letters. But after he was sentenced by the Sacramento court to life in prison without possibility of parole in May of 98. I wrote him again, this time to his new residence at the maximum security facility at Florence, Colorado. And we began corresponding. We corresponded for about 14 or 15 months. The last letters we exchanged were in the fall of 99.
Did you ever meet with him?
No, I had at one point in the spring of 99, he had invited me down to meet with him, and I regret having that was my fault. It was a time when I couldn't do it, and I wish I had now, looking back. But then in the fall of 99, I suggested that we meet, and he had just granted his only real interview, certainly the only interview to a mainstream journalist, and the previous month, and was very, very angry at the way in which that journalist wrote or described the interview to readers. And Kaczynski wrote me a very funny letter, actually, in which he said that he would never trust mainstream journalists again, and that he would only grant interviews to the most long-haired, unwashed, scruffy, bearded radicals.
And I guess that was
worse to that effect.
I guess that was not you.
I guess I'm not bearded. I didn't think of myself as a mainstream journalist, but he did think
of
me as one.
Professor Alston Chase, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious, and I'd like to talk with you in our next interview about why some people act on their desires to kill other people when many people think about it, but very few act.
Mm-hmm.
And then talk about the Kaczynski trial and what happened. But before we close, I'd like to ask you now if you could tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Yes, I just finished a book by an Oxford professor by the name of Niall Ferguson called The Pity of War. And it's a reexamination of World War One, and makes you feel sick to read it, I must say, because Ferguson presents an overwhelming case that World War One was absolutely unnecessary, and it killed millions upon millions of people. It changed, and of course, it ultimately set the stage for the rise of Hitler. So it was a major tragedy for the humanity for the 20th century, and as Professor Ferguson makes clear, it didn't have to happen.
Professor Alston Chase, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you. It's been a delight to be with you.
Alston Chase is the author of Harvard and the Unabomber, The Education of an American Terrorist. The book he finds most interesting is Pity of War by Niall Ferguson. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.